This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Well, the number of protesters at Mauna Kea swelled this weekend from a couple hundred to what some report to as close to 2,000. We've also seen smaller protests here on Oahu, including Waikiki this weekend. And there were also reports of freeway tie-ups due to rogue caravans, which state officials say is unsafe. HPR's Ryan Finnerty returned from the Big Island Friday. Ryan, lots of politicians weighing in on what to do as the protests percolate, not just here in the islands, but on the mainland.
Yeah, Catherine, it's kind of feast or famine. Last week was famine. We really weren't having much in the way of public officials weighing in. And then this week, as you mentioned, there have been a lot. On Friday, we heard from Governor David Ige directly. He held a press conference at Hilo Airport that members of the media were able to attend. And he just sort of took some questions on how the events have transpired and his handling of the situation on Mauna Kea. His main point that he made clear was he doesn't want to use police to sweep the demonstrators out. He doesn't want to have to use force to get them out of their position on the Mauna Kea access road. But he did maintain his previously stated position that they are breaking the law. And the governor also reiterated his commitment to building the TMT and to begin sending construction equipment up the mountain. Here's what he had to say.
We are looking at and planning for what is the best way to have a safe operation that can move equipment up the mountain. So we had made plans to increase police participation as the effort proceeded. You know, we'll continue to assess the situation. As I said, I am deciding not to escalate and add more National Guard troops because I don't want to exacerbate the situation. We will continue to reach out and engage as they are interested. Some have expressed interest, others have declined. You know, we are looking for ways to find common ground and find a way forward. Well, we did have the establishment of a Pu'u Honua, which is a traditional refuge where we agreed to be respectful of those inside the Pu'u Honua in exchange for them behaving and obeying orders and laws, and they are not. So the Pu'u Honua has fell apart. Now, you know, we continue to look for ways to resolve the conflict and allow construction to move forward.
And so, Catherine, that was Governor David Ige kind of giving his thoughts on the situation on Mauna Kea on Friday, so before this past weekend. And on the other side are the protesters, or the protectors, as they call themselves, who say they will not leave until construction has been stopped. They have strongly pushed back against a lot of the things the governor said in that press conference, including that claim we just heard that the Pu'u Honua has fallen apart. And just for a little bit of context for everyone, the Pu'u Honua is the camp area that is across the street from the Mauna Kea Access Road on the south side of Saddle Road, if you were looking at it on a map, and then the checkpoint, which is sort of the focal point of the protest that's actually on the Mauna Kea Access Road, is across the street from that. So they're kind of together but separate. And that Pu'u Honua, there was an agreement between the state and the demonstrators that that would not be swept. There wouldn't be any police there as long as certain rules were abided by. The governor says those rules have not been met. The agreement hasn't been upheld. The demonstrators push back against that and say that's not true. But their message from day one has been that we're not going until we stop the construction. And that was reiterated by almost everyone I talked to while I was there. They were committed to staying as long as it took to meet that goal. On the first day or two, it wasn't really clear to me that that was going to be possible with the number of people that were up there, the remoteness of the area. You know, it takes a lot of support to sustain that many people in an area that has pretty much no existing infrastructure. There's no water, no electricity, no source of supplies in the immediate area. Everything has to be brought up. And it seemed like to most of us watching that the state would just kind of wait it out for a little while in those opening days, that they'd be, you know, for lack of a better word, to starve them out, and that the movement would kind of lose steam and run out of gas and everyone would have to go home. But by the time I left last week, it had become pretty clear to me that the demonstrators were not only aware of the logistics required to sustain their protest, they were also rapidly taking steps to manifest that logistics operation. There's right now a kitchen that's capable of feeding at least 100 people at a time. There's a team of medics that are fully equipped with basic supplies going around the camp, checking on people, making sure everyone's drinking and getting enough sunscreen, drinking water, that is. There are half dozen portable toilets that are emptied every morning. And there was even an area in one tent where Lomi Lomi practitioners were giving massages to people who needed a little bit of rest. So I kind of wanted to learn how that was all happening, since that is such a huge undertaking. And I spoke with Marie Alohalani Brown. She is her day job is as a professor at the University of Hawaii's Department of Religion, but she is right now helping to manage the kitchen at the Pu'uhonua, which is supporting the demonstration. And she was also one of the kupuna who was arrested on Mauna Kea last week.
So what we're doing, and this is just one example, every day or every 2 days, we train people, they take over the whole day, and then they train the next group. So first of all, we're feeding, in the beginning it was maybe 20, 30 people. Now we're up to 100, at least 100 people pass through here and we're feeding them. We now have a recycling station. So every time somebody passes by, we teach them how to recycle.
So how is it all happening? Where is all this food coming from for all these people? All the medical supplies? How are the porta potties getting cleaned? How are you guys making it all happen?
Okay. The medic tent, they have their own website, Mauna Medics, and people send in send supplies, make donations there. I'm one of the people who puts out a kahea for anything that we need on the different Mauna Kea groups or on my personal webpage, and they're public. Hawaii Johns is doing an amazing job. They're bringing more porta potties today, and Drysin comes every morning to empty them because we have so many people that they fill up in less than 24 hours. And it's very important to us because this is a pu'uhonua. This place must be kept clean. Now we even have little Keiki, 8 years old, like that. And what they do is for 10 minutes, they have a little trash bag. For 10 minutes, they go around and pick up anything that somebody didn't notice that they dropped. So everybody helps. We have donations coming in for clothes. Some people come here, they're from Kona. They're from hotter parts of the island. They don't have clothes, but they're coming here anyways. So now we have all these blankets, socks, different kinds of clothing to help them. This is only possible because countless people are making donations, Hawaiians, non-Hawaiians, anyone who's helping us.
I saw at the front of the Pu'uhonua, there's a board for helping coordinate rides. Could you tell me a little about that?
Kanaka Uber.
Say that
I love
again,
it.
Please.
Kanaka Uber. I don't know who wrote that, but it's brilliant. Kanaka Uber. Yeah, so anybody needs a ride? I mean, there's different things that we're doing. There's the Kanaka Uber, who I don't know who it is, but I want to meet him or her. And then there's a list on the whiteboard of people who need rides, and then people who are willing to give rides. Now, we've also got donations, so we have gas cards. So I'm telling people, whoever feels like doing those kind of things or even making trash runs, they get a gas card.
And Catherine, Alohalani told me that most of the food and the supplies and services like the porta potty cleaning have been donated by local businesses or just members of the community, as she mentioned. And I even observed a number of local restaurants up there preparing hot food. One of them was even frying chicken on site. And it kind of reminded me of this famous quote in military history that amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics, and it appears to me that the demonstrators up there have kind of taken that proverb to heart, and it really does seem like they're prepared to make good on their promise to stay up there for quite some time.
Yeah, but it's just really interesting to see the politics that's happening to you. Lieutenant Governor up there this morning. I don't know how that sits with the governor. Mayor Harry Kim. So yeah, I'll be curious to see how this plays out over the next week.
Yeah, the governor really is a man on an island, both literally and figuratively, in this situation.
All right, very interesting. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Sure thing.
That was Ryan Finnerty talking about the standoff at Mauna Kea as we go into the second week of demonstrations from those who oppose the building of the 30-meter telescope. And while Native Hawaiians are holding demonstrations across the state in support of protesters, there are others, Native Hawaiians, who back the telescope and say they're a silent majority in this controversy. HBR's Ku'uwe Hirishi reports.
Demonstrators on the side of the road wave Hawaiian flags, carrying signs in support of protesters calling themselves Kia'i or Protectors of Mauna Kea. Tiana Henderson joined a recent rally at the Hawaii State Capitol.
We're here to be able to stand with our brothers and sisters who are in Mauna Kea, as well as all of our Kanaka Maoli throughout the world. So, you know, this is what we have to do.
On Hawaii Island, there's support for the other side of the telescope divide. Dozens rallied in Hilo backing the construction of the telescope. The numbers aren't large, but Jackie Hoover, a Big Island resident and TMT supporter, says there's a reason why telescope backers aren't as visible.
I have family, loved ones, ohana, who are on all fronts, the protectors, the supporters, law enforcement. So it's difficult for us as Hawaiians, as neighbors, ohana, and friends to really be confrontational with each other.
Hoover believes the telescope will provide jobs for local kids and diversify an island economy that's overly dependent on tourism. Hokulea master navigator Kalepa Babayan is also among those who have been vocal in their support of TMT. He says he backs the study of astronomy because it's a natural extension of traditional navigation. According to a 2018 Honolulu Star Advertiser poll, almost three-fourths of those Native Hawaiians and local residents surveyed backed the project. Mauna Kea astronomer Thane Curry, who is not Hawaiian, says this should make TMT support abundantly clear. But he says local residents have a lot more at stake than he does.
I believe what we're wanting to do here with TMT is something that's inspiring. But in principle, you know, I could just sort of withdraw from the controversy. And I think we have to understand that people who've been here for generations, they really can't withdraw from this issue.
That's true for Waimea native Kohoku Alohiokeao Lindsay Asing. He showed his support for the protest dancing hula at the state capitol rally. He says our kupuna say the land is sacred, and if we care for it, it will care for us. He says that's why we're all here at the capitol, to show aloha, loyalty, and empower one another. He says that's why Native Hawaiians need to keep fighting. Those that support TMT feel a similar commitment, but instead to support the telescope for the scientific knowledge it promises. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Kuvehi Hiraishi.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Your Monday morning backyard quiz is next. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking back to the time Hawaii audiences first saw our islands portrayed on a movie screen in living color. Real color photography took a while to arrive, but hand-tinted film was a big attraction in the silent movie days. And two of the earliest movies shot here, Hawaiian Love and The Shark God, released in 1913, had sequences that had been painted by hand at the studio. The use of actual color film didn't come until years later, although perhaps earlier than you might think. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of the first movie shot in the islands on actual color film. If you can tell us the name of the film used back then, well, you'll qualify as a dyed-in-the-wool cinema nerd. And for the rest of us, we'll be content with the name of the movie. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one who gets it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. We'll be right back.
a typical stadium event, you could see 100,000 cups thrown out.
Single-use cups for cold drinks, for beer, for coffee, straight to the trash. So vendors have started selling drinks in reusable cups. One problem, though.
Oh, I forgot my cup, and now I can't have a coffee.
But you can. Replacing the single-use cup, it's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
What's the latest medical research happening right here in the islands? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We're going to hear from the Hawaii Pacific Health Summer Research students about how their projects are changing healthcare right here at home in the areas of orthopedics, pediatrics, end-of-life care, concussions, and more. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
As we come off the big 50th anniversary of the moon landing, we take another angle on space for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Business reporter Stuart Yerton has a story about an idea for a space airport. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
So I really think this is a fascinating story about the moon's first airport.
Well, yes. This is Hank Rogers. He is a local entrepreneur, a very successful software developer who's done a lot of things here in Hawaii. And, his plan is to create a moon base that would consist of underground tunnels and structures that could be used as some kind of international moon base or space moon port, airport.
That's a wild and crazy idea.
Yeah, it's pretty wild and crazy. His idea, he says that SpaceX, you know, Elon Musk's company, could deliver a payload to the moon, and it would consist of robots that would go out and dig underground, and each of these would have specialized functions like earth-moving robots or digging robots, and again would create these tunnels underground that then people could go in and finish and put airlocks in and that sort of thing to make them habitable.
I love your description in your story where you talk about kind of like termites, right, building this thing.
That's right. That's the analogy that Mr. Rogers used, and it's pretty fascinating to think of. It might seem a little pie in the sky, but you know we are familiar with Hank Rogers' successes and some of the things he's done here. So, who knows?
Yeah, Mr. Tetris.
Right. So he made a fortune with an early role-playing game that was a big hit in Japan. He licensed Tetris and got Nintendo to put Tetris on the Game Boy, a handheld game device. So those were two big successes. And more recently, you know, he was behind helping the state or getting the state to adopt this energy policy of going to 100% renewable electricity by 2045. So he's done things. And if you recall back then, Governor Abercrombie said that Jeff Michelina, who was the head of Rogers's renewable energy group, the governor called him Harry Potter because his idea seemed so crazy. So who knows?
Well, it sounds like he wants to play with the other big boys, right? I mean, you talk about Elon Musk, Richard Branson.
Right, Jeff Bezos. All of these people are looking at space. I guess that's the thing you do these days. If you've got time and a lot of money, you start thinking, hey, let's go into space.
And you have this great picture of a hat, I guess, that Hank Rogers heads put together.
he's a painter as well, and he decorates and paints all kinds of things, and he had a couple of hats in there, on one of which he had painted the logo of this International Moon Base Alliance, which is the company.
So does it have a chance? What do you think?
I don't know. It again, if it were someone else, I would say it seems pretty far-fetched, but he's done some things that were pretty far-fetched and made them work, so I'm not going to write off this idea.
Now, you also talk in your story about how he's got a project on the Big Island, right?
Right. So if you recall, you've probably seen something about this years ago. He has this geodesic dome that's this Mars habitat where people go in and it's they're isolated and as if they're living on Mars for a long time. And I think a lot of it has to do with the psychology and psychological stress of being isolated and away from people for a long time. That's really the test of what they're looking at. But yeah, he has that called High Seas on the Big Island. He's talking about maybe doing more of the same sorts of stuff, but with moon simulations.
So there's lots of effort toward, you know, going back up there, lots of interest in the folks with deep pockets. What's the next step for Hank Rogers?
Well, it sounds like the next step is to try to get this research facility here in Hawaii. You know, one of the things that he is involved with is something called PISCES, which is called the Pacific International Space Center for Exploration Systems. This is the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism entity that deals with the state efforts to promote space exploration, such as we have them here. So I think the idea is to try to get NASA to actually spend some money, start doing more moon research here in Hawaii. As you said, the Trump administration wants to get back to the moon by 2024 now is their date. So who knows? Maybe there's an opportunity at least to get some work and business from that.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen, but gosh, you've got to think big, I guess, and hopefully these folks have the wherewithal to make some of these dreams happen.
That's right, Catherine. It's pretty wild stuff, but I guess you have to dream it to make it happen.
Yeah. And you know what your story is prompting us to do? We want to play some Tetris music, I think, to get us in the mood. But thanks a lot,
Excellent.
Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, go to sybilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm jazz vocalist Jonathan Courant from Las Vegas. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Looking for the best solutions to deal with our homeless crisis. This past Friday, City Councilwoman Carol Fukunaga paid a visit to a privately owned site in the Makali Mo'ili'ili area that's being eyed as a treatment facility for the most needy on the streets. Fukunaga recently wrote a letter to the state concerned about money set aside for case management for the homeless. She believes there's a faster way to deal with those with serious mental health issues.
Both Councilmember Kobayashi and I have probably the largest number of unsheltered homeless in our districts, and so many of the complaints we receive have to do with the fact that in some locations, you know, you have people who are mentally ill, others who have drug addiction issues, and so the disruption that those individuals cause within those neighborhoods, whether they're Chinatown, Ala Moana, Kaka'ako, Makali, is heartbreaking. So we said, you know, we already certified $6 million worth of state funds coming to the city for the HPD's Lift Zones, which is a project that they're doing, you know, in conjunction with city and state agencies. We want to see this additional $4.5 million go towards medical uses. And we think that's the best way of tackling many of the people who are unsheltered homeless on our streets.
Explain to our listeners what the Lift Zones are, because some folks might not be familiar with that concept.
The police department came up with a proposal which would allow them to establish Lift Zones, which would be sort of a location within a city or state park or in the community where they would set up these tent type of structures that are pretty much the type that emergency first responders use, you know, in cases of disasters, etc. They're very durable. They're very resilient. They can be set up almost immediately. And what the police would do is they would be managing and policing the perimeter of that particular lift zone. They can offer people short-term, you know, stays in this tent-type structure, but they would also be providing a lot more access to homeless services, outreach, social services, help getting an ID and all the other kinds of things that can help them move towards obtaining housing.
And this is different than the tent city that we saw at Ala Park under Mayor Fossey years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. These types of tents would be designed for short term. You know, you set them up quickly and then you can move them to another area where you're going to establish a lift zone. And so what they have done in this intervening time period since they first brought it up last year is they've made presentations to neighborhood boards, to city and state agencies. And I think everyone understands that having something that the police are managing is probably a good first step towards providing an alternative to shelters or locations that people are unwilling to accept referrals to.
And you reached out to us because we recently had a call-in show talking about homelessness on the neighbor islands, and one of the issues that came up was they don't have enough beds, treatment beds, for a lot of the folks that are mentally ill on those neighbor islands.
And that is actually very true of Oahu as well. And, you know, just as kind of a little bit of background and history, in the much earlier times, you know, 20 years ago when we had federal moves to deinstitutionalize people with mental health challenges, you know, we closed down Waimano Home. People were supposed to be serviced and treated within community centers, but a lot of that actually disappeared, you know, after the Great Recession in 2008. And so many of the kinds of services that we would expect to rely upon for people with mental health or even drug addiction needs really took a big hit in the 2008 to 2018 period. So today we're actually seeing the impact of all of those kinds of budgetary decisions.
And a lot of those people that need help are out on the streets.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so the more we can invest and utilize, you know, some of the programs and treatment services that Lieutenant Governor Green, Department of Health, Queens Hospital, and many other health care providers have been advocating for, the better, because the use of monies for more direct, immediate, short-term health care and medical services can actually save a lot of money by removing a lot of the impacts on emergency rooms, on ambulance services, police, you know, and all kinds of other social services that are really hard to come by.
So you sent this letter. Have you got a response back yet?
Not in writing, but we are actively working with a number of private sector property owners where we are looking to pull together some examples of properties that could perhaps be retrofitted for sort of mini H4 types of medical treatment locations in and around Councilmember Kobayashi's and my districts. And we want to go back to Department of Community Services and Department of, State Homeless Coordinator Morishige to say, how about these as some, you know, more practical alternatives?
And then you mentioned H4. What is H4?
H4 is the medical triage program that is being set up in the second and mezzanine floors of the Kuili Street Punawai rest stop, you know, where the ground floor is really a very impressive range of showers, bathrooms, and laundry facilities.
Right, the hygiene centers.
Hygiene center where people can actually obtain some assistance and receive services while they're getting their laundry cleaned, while they're, you know, able to access showers and bathrooms. And it's really turned out to be a very, very positive next step.
And why do they call it H4?
H4 is Homeless Healthcare, Hawaii Homeless Healthcare, HUI, or mm-hmm. I forgot the acronym. H4 is just a quick shorthand.
Right. So we definitely then need to be paying more attention to what are the serious problems that we're seeing and how do we impact those immediately.
Absolutely. Because I think the people who see a lot of the homeless who have severe mental health or other kinds of addiction issues on the street, people want to help, but they don't know what the most appropriate step is. So, you know, for those homeless individuals who just need a leg up and for whom housing, you know, is kind of the first step. We're happy that, you know, that group of homeless individuals can be helped. But I think the next most difficult area is to tackle those with medical needs. And if we can provide neighborhood types of medical treatment facilities, you know, with crisis beds, et cetera, that would go a long way towards bringing a lot more services into each community.
So you said you've gotten some good reception from some private homeowners, and you're working with them right now. So is the idea then you've got to get the buy-in, though, from other people that are involved in this effort?
I think we have a lot of buy-in from community stakeholders. I think it's more getting state and county agencies as well as private property owners. You know, we have some quite a number of private property owners with small-scale commercial buildings that are willing to help out if they see a way forward, you know, for improvements in their neighborhood. So I think it's more that sort of public-private partnership that we're pursuing at this point.
So what would be in it for them?
We can put together perhaps the appropriate financing and other structures that would allow them to use their properties for these purposes. That would really be the key.
Okay, and then maybe get a tax break.
Tax break or payment for services, you know, that are going to be provided by healthcare professionals, et cetera.
And so, gosh, you talked about planning to do a site visit to show folks what you're talking about.
Absolutely. We do have one scheduled with the state folks, and so we're keeping our fingers crossed. We have done a number of visits with other individuals thus far, and I think everyone who has seen these facilities agrees that this is a much faster route towards getting neighborhood triage centers in place.
But is there anything that you personally have seen on the street that maybe touched your heart, or just?
It's mostly the medical challenges. I think when, you know, in Chinatown, one devastating thing is that you have people who are either passed out, you don't know whether they're dead or alive, and, you know, you try and get some medical assistance for them. It's very scary, and I have parents and preschool administrators, you know, in and around the downtown area, who often give us really horrifying stories about what they encounter, you know, when they're taking their children to and from school. So this is definitely an issue that we have to come to grips with.
That was Honolulu City Councilwoman Carol Fukunaga, who sat down with us last week to talk about a potentially faster way to deal with the mentally ill on our streets. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we may try to spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips, grateful to have him on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the southwestern sky around 8 p.m. Both planets are bright and easy to spot. The moon this week is waning, passing through its last quarter phase, which means, of course, a return to dark skies by week's end.
And I understand you have an update on a Asia-Pacific space mission.
Yes, what goes up must eventually come down. And in the case of China's Tiangong 2 space station, this is exactly what happened. On the morning of July 18, at around 10 a.m. Eastern Time, the space station underwent a controlled deorbit burn that saw it enter the atmosphere, burn up, and the remains eventually crashing to Earth in the South Pacific. This sees the end of China's second major manned space station after 3 years of service.
I guess this was planned, but 3 years doesn't seem like all that long to have been up there.
Yep, you're right. This is quite short in terms of lifespan for an orbital facility. But the space station had previously experienced some problems, and there were delays in upgrades from the Chinese Space Agency, so the decision was made to decommission the spacesuit.
When did the people who were on there working stop working on the facility?
So they stopped working there in 2017, so it's been unmanned for quite a while.
That's interesting. And reflecting on the purpose of the thing to begin with?
Well, it was originally designed to test life support, refueling, and resupply capabilities that are crucial to maintaining an inhabited space station in low Earth orbit. And for a while, things were going very well. But, you know, these delays for upgrades and expansions to the station sort of signaled the end of its life. And so, without continued support, the Chinese decided to deorbit it.
They still have some stuff on the moon, right?
They have unmanned probes, yes, on the moon and in orbit around the Earth.
And how about Mars?
Currently, there is no Chinese presence on Mars, at least not yet.
Right. Well, that's what we'll be looking for in the future. And you mentioned this thing coming down in the South Pacific. A little more on that?
Well, what didn't burn up in the atmosphere is now sitting at the bottom of the ocean in a place we've come to know as the satellite graveyard. It's about halfway between New Zealand and Chile, and there's about 264 spacecraft down there.
Wow. So that could be a whole industry itself, huh? Hauling those up and then selling them to somebody who wants to spend their money on that.
Lucrative space salvage.
Exactly. It's Christopher Phillips, another fascinating report here on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We keep these segments archived at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Natural Energy Laboratory of Hawaii Authority's Hawaii Gateway Energy Center in Kailua Kona. FerraroChoi.com.
Last week, we put together a call-in show focusing on the legacy and the memory of the Apollo 11 lunar mission. Now, the discussion drew some lively comments on our talkback line, with some listeners saying that scientific ambition in the state of Hawaii should be reprioritized. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Sue. I'm calling from Hilo, Hawaii, of course. And my comment is, before we go to Mars or back to the moon, we need to feed all the hungry children in this country. I do not understand a country that can't feed all of its children and prioritizes something in space. I understand about all of the advances that come from these kinds of explorations, but at the same time, we have an obligation to feed all these children that large numbers of people insist have a life here on Earth. Thank you.
Hi, this is Arnie Rabin calling from Honaunau, Kona, Hawaii. I'd like to respond to the comments made on the conversation by the scientific community stating that they have contributed a lot to scientific and STEM education in Kona. As a parent and a grandparent and president of the PTA and member of Educational Association, I could categorically state they have not. And we sorely need more STEM education here and more scientific education, and we would really welcome the funds. I'm not just talking about what they do, which is one night a year putting on some dog and pony show, but meaningful contribution. The telescope is funded by nations that have huge budgets. I mean, they have the resources to give a great scientific education to every single kid on this island. So put their money where their mouth is. Thank you.
And Brad in Kona shared this comment about an exhibit at a Big Island museum. He says the moon rocks at the Onizuka Space Museum at Kona Airport look just like lava blue rock with little sparkles in the rock, like, you know, full of sodium and calcium, and not like surface lava. Well, thanks for your feedback. You know, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line 808-792-8217.
things that you might like to see, but they're all addressed to me.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked for the name of the first movie shot on color film in the islands. Wisely, the filmmakers looked for the most spectacular images, and they found them on Hawaii Island. Kilauea, the Hawaiian volcano, was photographed in 1918 using the now long-forgotten Prismacolor color process. Now, the earliest feature film was 1930s Leathernecking, which was actually shot on the mainland, mostly in black and white. And the first all-color feature, and some would say not one of American cinema's greatest treasures, was the 1942 Song of the Islands, starring Betty Grable and Victor Mature. Part of it, at least, was film on the Big Island. Congratulations to Julio from Honolulu. You got it right. That's our backyard quiz for today. If you have one for us, we would love to use it. You can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That's today's quiz. They were siblings who shared a gift of songwriting. They also happened to be Hawaiian ali'i. The Mission House Museum plays host to special concert series honoring our departed monarchs. The Mele Music Series kicked off earlier this summer with the work of Princess Miriam Likelike, mother of Princess Ka'iulani. HPR was in the audience. Take a listen to this song that she co-wrote with the Queen and others. Cultural Program Coordinator Po'ai Lincoln does the honors.
It was composed around 1868 and most likely was written in Hamohamo, which was the Waikiki home of our Queen Liliuokalani. You will hear some of the influences that we have on our Hawaiian music from the outside world. This is a waltz, and it has a Viennese kind of style to it. We're not going to be doing it as a waltz, but that's how it was originally written. But you can hear these influences that the Queen had, or that the Queen and our Princess had on the music that they were listening to, the music of the time, and the songs that they were writing.
Under the stars and in the audience at night, a woman who traces her family lineage to Princess Miriam Likelike and her husband Archibald Cleghorn. Likelike Davis's great-grandmother was one of Cleghorn's three daughters from a previous relationship, so they were Princess Ka'iulani's half-sisters from the Scottish side. Davis was thrilled to be a part of the intimate gathering honoring her namesake.
I found it to be a wonderful tribute to Likelike's music, the first of four events for Ilani'eha, and I hope that I can continue to go to all of them, or as many of them as possible. My grandmother was Miriam Mabel Kalikaho Robertson Lucas. Her mother was Rose Kaipula Cleghorn, who was one of three of Princess Ka'iulani's half-sisters. So they were the daughters of Archibald and were adopted by Princess Likelike before Ka'iulani was born. So that's how we fit into the genealogy.
So what can you expect for the remaining concerts in this Mele series at the Mission House Historic Site? Well, in addition to spotlighting the royal songwriters, the museum is also preparing to celebrate the bicentennial of the arrival of the missionaries in the islands, including the life of Henry Opukahaia, one of the first native Hawaiian Protestant missionaries who died on the East Coast. It's a history that's being showcased through many events at the museum and abroad. Po'ai Lincoln shares what's in store for us.
It is our Mele series. This is several years we have done this now, and this is going to be the last one for a little while. We're going to take a little bit of a hiatus because Bicentennial is coming up next year in 2020, so we'll have a lot of other festivities happening on the grounds. But this particular program is really to focus in and tell the story of the important role of Hawaiian music in our history and how it was influenced by this space and that particular time in the early 1800s, how Hawaiian music evolved. It is one of the few things where there was large outside influence, missionary influence and foreign influence, that the Hawaiian aesthetic really came through. It did not get swallowed. It became this beautiful collection of the two sources.
And it's just remarkable because this evening, you know, you mentioned that these songs are like, you know, 200 years old.
Yeah.
And they're just so they're familiar still, to everybody.
Yes, and they're still sung, they're still performed, they're still danced to, and especially like tonight with Sanoi, the arrangement of Sanoi, that is Kopono's arrangement, and he makes it sound like a brand new song. And when you look at the lyrics and the stories they were telling, they're the same stories that we still tell now. And our ali'i who wrote these songs, they lived lives just like the rest of us.
You paid homage to Like Like, and I have to admit, she was one that I did not know a lot about.
There really isn't much to be known. There isn't much about her. And one of seven, and the four that we talk about, Like Like is the least spoken of. And so there are others, three other that had shorter lives who did not live very long. One of their siblings was only 3 years old when she passed. But Like Like really, she kind of kept to her own. She was very much, she was a sovereign woman in a way. She very much had her own life. Her daughter, Ka'iulani, is kind of how we know her the most as. And she wasn't really here on Oahu often. She would kind of go away to Hawaii Islands. But the music that she does have, the few songs that were written by her that are still in existence to this day, are stunning. They're just beautiful pieces.
And it was really nice to have one of the descendants here tonight.
Yes, Auntie Like Like Davis was here. That was really, really wonderful. That was really cool.
So for folks who are not familiar with the Mele series, so you're going to complete the year with three more.
Yes, we have three more to round out the Nalani'eha. So our next performance is going to be on July 27th, and that's going to be in honor of Prince William Pitleleuhoku. He has a little bit more music than his sister Like Like and a lot more love songs. So that's going to be really fun. We're going to kind of get more into the kauna of his music. So that is on July 27th. And then we'll be celebrating Lili'u Okalani September 21st. They're always on a Saturday. So Lili'u Okalani is on September 21st. Her birthday is earlier in the month, but that's the date that we chose for her. So the final one will be for Kalakaua, and that's actually on his birthday, which is November 16th. So that is going to be a huge, huge festival. We're going to have choirs singing. We're going to have a big shindig for our king's birthday, because that's how he would have done it. It's his kind of party, yeah.
You mentioned you were going to take a break, so this will kind of complete the series for this year. Mm-hmm. And then what can we look forward to with the Bicentennial?
Well, with Bicentennial, we actually kick off Bicentennial in October of this year. So October, September into October, Moses Goods, the actor, and myself will be traveling to the continent. We're going to be in New England, touring up and down the New England coast in the areas that Opukahaia himself was. And we'll be touring Moses's script called My Name is Opukahaia and my companion piece, which is telling the story of Hawaiian music. So there will be a lot of elements of music that I'll be doing. And we've got a full schedule schedule, we're going to be all over the place in the East Coast.
So will we be able to see a snippet of that before you take the show on the road?
I believe the plan is to have a performance done here before we head out. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And then more to follow.
And then way more to follow. Yeah. We have a whole new set of Cemetery Pupu Theater for Bicentennial. We have a playwriters. We've been doing a lot of work with our communities, a lot of reach outs with our different community members, specifically playwriters, or play builders. Sorry, Play Builders Hawaii is completing a script about the story from the descendants' point of view. So they've been interviewing descendants and hearing their stories. And there will be a play that will be premiering in April of 2020. We're also going to be, if you are familiar with our history theater productions that we do, Cemetery Pupu Theater, and then our special history theater productions, where we take historical figures and we tell their stories. And one of the projects that is in the works right now is the Ali'i Letters. So we're going to be taking some of our higher ranking ali'i during that time period, and from their actual letters that they wrote back and forth that we have in our archives, we're going to be writing scripts for those as well.
Okay, so showcasing all this wonderful history.
Yes, yes, that's what we do here, yeah. Well,
mahalo for your time.
Thank you very much, mahalo nui.
And again, the upcoming mele concert honoring Prince William Pitt Lilihoku is this Saturday. And we should note that while other monarchs across the globe were hiring songwriters, Hawaii's royals wrote poetry and songs that we still hear today. Here's Melvin Leeds singing Maika'i Waipio, said to be written by Princess Likelike for Queen Emma, whose beauty reminded her of Waipio.
Maika'i Waipio, Epo ai apuni ana ahapamakai mae mae kapua ikaholu ae akawai ua e
You know, we have run out of time, but we would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line, leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.